Good afternoon, and welcome to Community News, covering the towns of Marlborough, Hudson, Harvard, Stowe, and Poulton. This program is intended for a print and peered audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. The program is sponsored in part by the Lions Clubs of Ashland, Poulton, and Harvard. And thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, we'll be bringing you news from the Community Advocate, the Harvard Press, the Stowe Independent, and Bolton Independent. And today we are reading from the Community Advocate from May 1st, the Harvard Press from April 24th and May 1st, and the Stowe and Bolton Independent. We're going to start tonight in Harvard. The Cultural Council held reception to honor the 2026 grant recipients. The Harvard Cultural Council, part of a network of 324 local cultural councils in the state, has announced its grant recipients for 2026 and held a reception to honor them last Sunday at the Harvard Senior Center. Councilor Chair Marika Vallès described the reception as a chance to honor the work of artisan arts organizations in Harvard. This year, the council funded 17 grants, totaling $6,980. Recipients, including Sam Gold from the Open Door Theater of Acton, Steve Abrams from the Harvard Historic Society, Linda Shoemaker from Ensemble, Eclectic, Michael Killian from Warner Free Lectures, and Christopher Chalifoux from the 4th of July Committee. They will describe their projects at the reception. We are particularly excited about the range and quality of Harvard Cultural Council funding projects this year. Each project was chosen because of its substantial public benefit for the residents of Harvard. Special guests included Senator James Eldridge and State Representative Danilo Sena. So far, Harvard Select Board members Susan Mary Redeker and Almet Cora Siaglu have confirmed attendance and had Greg Torreson, the Harvard's liaison from the Massachusetts Cultural Council. The Cultural Council is part of a 329 local councils that serve 351 cities and towns across Massachusetts. And the network is the largest grassroots cultural funding program in the country, supporting thousands of community-based projects in the arts, sciences, and humanities every year. The state legislature provides an annual appropriation to the Massachusetts Cultural Council, which then allocates funds to each community in the network. The HCC will seek application this fall, October of 2026, for next year's funding. Information and forms are available online at massculturalcouncil.org. The committee votes on the grants in November. It is a reimbursement program, and only after the event is held can a reimbursement form be submitted for review by the chair and treasurers. Other members of the council include Peter Jackson as the secretary, Margaret Murphy as the treasurer, Jen Slavin and Harriet Friedrich and Stacey Hagus. And the council is looking for additional members. So, the grant recipients for 2026, 5 Sparks, 2 Across, Discovery Museum, Open Door Connections, Camp Devens and Harvard Exhibit, the Harvard Historic Society Audio Improvement, Arm in Arm, Library Cultural Displays and Art Projects, Ellen Harrison Mowich, Orchard Women, Open Door Theater of Acton for Honk, Harvard Council on Aging for Irish Voices, Linda Shoemaker, Ensemble Electra, In Concert, and Early Music Meets Jazz. Warner Free Lecture, Bromfield Student Lectures, Acton Community Center, Child's Play, Fitchburg Art Museum, the 90th Regional Exhibit of Art and Craft, Meredith Childs Adult Improv Workshops, Harvard Park and Recreation Summer Concert Series, the Harvard Town Band 4th of July Parade, and the Harvard Town 4th of July Celebration, and Marcos Vales Music and Movement with Rockabye Beats. April frost did less damage to orchards than was feared. It was a close call, but the recent cold snap seemed to have done only limited damage to Harvard's orchards. However, as Chris Green of Westwood Orchard said, it's still pretty early in the game to know what's going on. The late April frost, especially after an early warm spell, was a sharp reminder of the disastrous weather of 2023. That year, Harvard orchardists lost their entire crop of peaches, nectarines, and cherries, and there was a heavy damage to the apple crop as well. This year, the apple blossoms were at a vulnerable stage in late April, Green said, and some were damaged, especially by the coldest nights, April 20th and 21st, when temperatures fell as low as 29 degrees in Worcester County. It's a percentage, not like a 100% wipeout. They were all hurt by any stretch, Green said. He noted some parts of Westwood's orchards are at a fairly high elevation in town, which often always provides some protection because the coldest air settles in low-lying areas. Christine Turnheim of Good Spirits Farm said her trees are always a little late to flower because of her location at the foot of Bear Hill. But her peach blossoms look a little light now. It will be a bumpier crop this year, she predicted, and she isn't sure how the apricots will do. Cold is not the only weather problem for orchardists, though. Green, Lawson, and Carlson all mentioned they expected the bees that are brought in as pollinators to arrive soon, perhaps this week. Turnheim has her own hives, and as Green pointed out, a long stretch of rainy weather can keep the bees from doing their job. For Harvard residents looking forward to peaches later in the summer, Carlson had a hopeful prediction that was handed down in her family. If the forsythia is good, it should be a good peach year. And all around Harvard, forsythia bushes seem to be blooming very well indeed. Harvard Select Board approves the general store patio upgrade. The Select Board unanimously voted to approve a proposal to renovate the patio adjacent to the Harvard General Store at its meeting on Tuesday, April 28th. The plan was presented by building owners Matt Meralda and Betsy Starr and outlined their intent to privately fund upgrades to the outdoor community space that they believe would improve accessibility, safety, and overall usability of the area between the parking lot and the cemetery. In an interview with the press, Meralda said his and Starr's primary goal is to enhance the area they view as central to the community. This is such a cool place, said Meralda. The problem is not super accessible, and it could be a little bit nicer. The patio, which sits on town-owned land, has become a popular destination for general store patrons who enjoy the venue's outdoor dining, movie nights, and other events. However, its current gravel surface and proximity to the parking lot presents challenges, particularly for those with limited mobility. A few months after Matt and Betsy bought the building, we sat down with them and talked about some of the functional deficiencies of the store, said business owner Scott Haywood in an interview with the press. Matt came up with this idea of putting down pavers, and we think we're going to make the patio much more accessible. The proposed redesign emphasizes four principles: accessibility, safety, permeability, and non-permanence. The plan proposed to the select board showed two phases to the renovation. Phase one, expected to begin in the first week of May, would take approximately 2 weeks to complete and includes most of the patio. Meraldo said Phase 2 would take only a week to complete, but since it includes the area abutting the general store, he will need to coordinate with building renovations such as a new fire escape being installed adjacent to the patio. Meraldo worked with local landscaping designer Mamie Weichrall on a concept to install hardscape pavers to replace two-thirds of the existing gravel, allowing for easier navigation and more functional seating. Additionally, planters featuring green screening to create a buffer between the patio and the adjacent parking lot were proposed, as well as new modular furniture added to the current picnic table seating options. When given the opportunity to ask questions and provide feedback on the initiative, Select Board Member Ahmed Korab Sioglu suggested Meraldo and Starr confer with the town's Commission on Disabilities to ensure accessibility. Eric Ward expressed his desire to see a designed walking path on either side of the planters to facilitate safe navigation of the area between the patio and the parking lot. Eve Wittenberg asked for native species could be used for the planters. Meraldo and Starr responded favorably to all comments made by the board, and the vote to approve the project commenced in under 10 minutes. I think everyone feels a sense of pride in the common and in the store, said Katie Kroll, manager of the General. We all stand on the shoulders of the people who came before us. We are stewards of this town, this land, and we look out for it. Yeah. Trash bag vending machine to be installed at Hildreth House this summer. In response to residents' complaints that town trash bags are too hard to find, the town has purchased a vending machine to dispense the bags from the porch of Hildreth House. The cash-only machine will be installed under an awning and monitored by cameras. The bags should be available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, interim town administrator Don Dunbar told the press this week. She said DPW Director Eric Ryder arranged the purchase of the $9,000 machine, which is scheduled to be usable by July. Until the town can establish the financial infrastructure needed to handle the credit and debit card fees, Dunbar said the machine will take only cash. The select board voted last month to raise the price of the town trash bags, citing the need to cover the rising cost of trash disposal. Starting July 1st, a package of 5 15-gallon bags will rise from $5 to $10, while a bag of 5 30-gallon bags will cost $20 instead of $10. Also, effective July 1st, transfer station stickers will rise by $10 to $140, though residents over 60 will continue to pay $130. Currently, trash bags are available in Harvard only as Westwood Orchards, which is open seasonally from June through December. Harvard Power on Aya Road stopped selling the bags several years ago, while the general store stopped carrying them in February. Bags are available in Ayer at Taroko Tractor, Moore Lumber and Hardware, and Shop and Save, and in Acton at Roach Brothers, in Littleton at Donnelly's, and at the Market Basket in Maynard. At the meeting on April 13th, the Harvard Board of Health voted unanimously to find an occupied house in Harvard unfit for habitation and ordered that it be vacated by May 1. The occupant and her son did not object. At the meeting, Jim Gareffi, Director of Public Health at Neshoba Associated Boards of Health, said that they learned midwinter that there was a house in Harvard without running water. The NABH asked for a plumbing report and arranged for one of their nurses to make a wellness check. Reports came back that something had happened to the water supply between the well and the house during the winter so that only a trickle made it into the house. Enough to slow fill the toilet bowl tank, but not enough for other purposes. In addition, the heating system no longer worked. The occupant managed to space heat his and bottled water. Damaged ceilings indicated a leaking roof. So on March 18th, Garofoli met with the homeowner and her younger son to, as he put it, chart a path forward. She had been looking for another place to live in her old age, but without success. NABH would consider a path forward that led either to remediating the defects in the house or to vacating the house, and NABH would allow time for either. We can make someone homeless, or we can work with them to get them to finish. So it's a challenge ahead. We're going to take a break for a public service announcement, and when we come back, Bob Brady will be joining us with more news.
This is a public service announcement from the Massachusetts Association for the Blind. The Massachusetts Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired provides assistive technology training for persons with visual impairments. If you or a family member are interested in receiving one-on-one specialized training, please contact 617-991-7073 or email atcenter@mabcommunity.org.
This is Bob Brady with Audio Journal. The time is 3:16. I'm going to read articles from the Marlboro Hudson Community Advocate. Theater Central to Marlboro Residents Relationship by Sophia Opetisiano. Donnie Belergian and David Bertie met in Paradise. At least that was the name of the now defunct bar in Cambridge, where Belergian took refuge on a rainy night back in 1990. Neither can remember who approached whom, but 36 years later, the Marlboro residents look back fondly on that night and what they connected over. Theater. Belergian fell in love with show business as a first grader after landing the lead role in his grammar school's original musical. Bertie was a third grader when he found a book of plays in his classroom and asked his teacher if he and his classmates could perform one. While the pair didn't have access to big theater programs in high school, both performed in yearly plays or musicals, and Belergian began singing with a friend who would invite him to accompany her on the piano during free periods at school. I was hooked because I made the audience laugh, and because of that, I became everybody's friend, Belergian said. Bertie studied at Boston University and worked at a series of theaters, including the Boston Shakespeare Company, before working professionally with Actors Equity Association. Then he left acting and took a 5-year break before he met Belergian, who convinced him to audition for a musical at Volks Theater in Wayland, their home-based theater. Now the two have acted and directed locally for community theaters for over 30 years, often working on productions together, like their current project, 1776. Bertie is acting in the production, while Belergian is directing and producing alongside students from Wayland High School. Belergian began directing after giving notes to actors while he was a producer on a show. I thought, well, if I can give them notes that were constructive enough to get the performances that they gave, and seeing that they actually took some of the things that I gave them, I guess I can direct, he said. Bertie said he stumbled into directing after pitching the play Come Back, Little Shiva to Hovey Players. I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict, and I always wanted to direct this play, which is about a drunk, and I decided I was going to pitch it. To my surprise, with no credit, no credentials, they said, okay. So I directed it, and I just loved it. I got hooked. Bertie prefers being up on stage, while Belergian loves the director's chair. However, they both agree that theater offers escapism. Belergian said theater offers human contact you can't get from going to the movies. You need a collective experience, and you need the arts. Theater provides all of that, he said. Theater makes you think you can go to a movie, which is great, but there is something about live theater, the give and take of the audience and the people on stage, said Bertie. You're moved by things that happen. It's the old cliche, You laugh, you cry. But there's nothing like live theater to both raise your awareness and entertain you. Hudson, meet Magnus. Hudson Police Department welcomes new canine officer by John Bishop. You can add Magnus to the Hudson Police Department's roster of canine officers. Soon, the Black Labrador Retriever will join Officer Cameron O'Toole on the beat and four-legged members of the department, Murph and Jocko. I've always loved dogs and animals, and I love my job. If a canine position ever opened, I wanted to do it, but I didn't expect to anytime soon. We already have our comfort dog, Murph, and our patrol dog, Jocko, said O'Toole. I've had dogs my entire life, bulldogs, boxers, golden retrievers. I never personally had a lab. When it was made known that Hudson would be getting a new canine, a handful of officers showed interest and interviewed. The chief narrowed down the candidates before officially deciding. O'Toole's experience with dogs comes from family. His siblings owned Labrador Retrievers, which are known for their gentle temperament, especially with children. That was important to me, having young kids at home, said O'Toole, who grew up in Grafton. O'Toole's youngest is just over a year old, and his oldest is turning 5. Magnus fits well into the situation, as he is incredibly patient, especially with the toddler. He's going to be a community canine and will be at all of our community events. He'll also serve as an EOD, Explosive Ordnance Detection, canine, with the job of detecting explosives, firearms, or shell casings, said O'Toole. We'll be at Gillette Stadium for Patriots games, concerts, the Boston Fireworks on July 4th, and the Boston Marathon. He added, if we receive a gun-related call from another town and they need a canine, Magnus and I have the ability to go to that town or city and assist with locating evidence. But before O'Toole and Magnus officially join the team, they have one important step left, completing the intensive training they began in January. That's when the partnership really forms. My dog is a food reward dog, so whenever I'm training him, he's getting fed. Even on days off, I still have to put hides out, whether that be explosive scents, firearms, or shell casings, and train him, O'Toole said. That's how he gets fed. Magnus's path to becoming a police dog had an interesting twist before training began. He previously served as a guide dog for Guiding Eyes, leading a blind handler. But Magnus sniffed too much, something undesirable in that line of work, which forced a change in careers. They pulled him from that program, and they put him into my program, and he is unbelievable doing what he does now, O'Toole said. Magnus's consistent training, which will continue indefinitely, will keep his constantly sniffing schnoz in shape. During formal canine training, Magnus and O'Toole traveled across the Commonwealth, including trips to Bridgewater, UMass Amherst, and other locations. Each day includes 3 sessions with 10 to 18 hides per session. The dog searches, detects the scent, sits, and is rewarded, O'Toole said. Once training ends, I'll return to patrol. Magnus will always be with me. O'Toole's cruiser is equipped with a kennel system, temperature monitoring, and automatic safety features. And with their training and partnership completed, the pair will soon join the town's other officers. According to O'Toole, Jocko, Murph, and Magnus get along well. Magnus and Murph will play together, but Jocko is more work-driven. All 3 dogs and their partners will continue to serve Hudson, and it's likely you'll see them around town. Hudson Town Meeting to consider $7.25 million spend to repair two school roofs. Voters at Hudson Town Meeting considered articles to fund school roof repairs, create an audit committee, and spend PFAS settlement money that started arriving last year. So I know that the meeting is passed, but I don't have results of the vote yet. Article 22 asks for a borrowing authorization of $7.25 million for roof and HVAC improvements at Hudson High School and C.A. Farley Elementary School. The roofs of both schools are in various states of disrepair, with some sections needing immediate work. The proposal was pitched as a three-year program to fix the aging structures. Voters would have the option to raise the money through borrowing or otherwise. If town meeting passes Article 22, the funding package would still be subject to a vote in the May 11th town election. Debt service for the roof would extend out about 10 years, according to recent presentations from town officials. Town meeting voters will also be asked to approve $1.66 million for design, permitting, and construction of a replacement to Chestnut Hill Well Number 3. The project would be funded by payments that Hudson started receiving last year from a lawsuit against manufacturers of PFAS. Contamination from the so-called forever chemicals forced Hudson to disconnect a well after discovering potentially toxic levels of the substances. The proposed operating budget for fiscal 2027, including schools, is $98.6 million. That's up about $5 million from last year. The school portion of the budget is $50.4 million. Capital expenses for the next fiscal year would total almost $4.9 million if approved at town meeting. The largest single capital expense is $1.17 million for an aerial ladder truck. Also included in the capital budget, climate control at Joseph L. Mulready Elementary School and Forest Avenue Elementary School, and $300,000 to replace the high school auditorium lighting. There are two similar but competing proposals to establish an audit committee that would provide a new layer of review over town finances. The idea was first broached last fall by Finance Committee member Ryan Biss just hours after he was appointed to the committee. Biss said an audit committee would provide enhanced monitoring of the town's financial compliance. Biss's proposal is a citizen's petition. The select board submitted its own version in the town meeting warrant, and both will be considered. Another citizen's petition would amend the town's flag policy to restore the so-called Salucci Memorial, the Canadian flag on one of the two lesser flagpoles at the site. Former Massachusetts Governor Paul Salucci was a Hudson native and served as ambassador to Canada. He died in 2013 of Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. Marlborough Counselor Deployed to Active Military Duty by Sophia Opetisiano. Marlborough's Ward 7 Counselor and Navy Reservist and Commander Matthew Sargent has been deployed to active military duty, leaving one of the City Council seats vacant for at least 170 days. City Council President Michael Ossing said the council will be taking care of Sargent's work during his absence. A majority vote will still require 6 votes, and a supermajority will require 8. Ossing said he is confident the city council will operate normally and noted a recent 13-month stretch when the council operated with only 10 members after the passing of the late city councilor Donald Landers. Sargent was elected to the Ward 7 seat in November 2025 and has worked for years to discover the stories of Marlborough's deceased veterans. He has marked hundreds of graves for fallen Marlborough men and women. A lifelong Marlborough resident, Sargent helped organize the Medal of Liberty ceremony that honored residents who died during World War II and assisted with the research that led to the naming of the Goodnow Brothers School, the softball field at the high school after Richard Deemers, and the baseball field at Whitcomb after Harold Cole. During his campaign for city council, Sargent said, "I care about the city and want to make sure the direction the city heads in is right for those folks who have and will continue to call Marlborough home, like me." Now let's listen to a public service announcement, and then Alan will bring us more news.
Listen to Audio Journal on your smart speaker. Just say, "Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn," or, "Hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn."
One last item from Harvard. The Bear Hill Pond Watershed Management Committee announced at its April 27th meeting that it received a grant aimed at expanding community education around watershed stewardship to help residents better understand how everyday water household decisions affect the water health of the pond. The committee was awarded $4,490 to put toward initiatives such as townwide mailers and water quality expert speaker events. According to the committee, approximately 500 homes, or a quarter of Harvard's households, are within the pond's 2,427-acre watershed, meaning runoff from lawns, driveways, and streets across town ultimately drains into Bear Hill Pond. Grant-funded educational materials will emphasize practical steps residents can take, such as reducing fertilizer use, managing pet waste, limiting road salt, and maintaining natural vegetation buffers to prevent runoff. This project translates years of technical watershed planning into something residents can actually use, the application says. Emphasizing small changes across many households can have a cumulative effect on water quality. The initiative has drawn strong support from local organizations, including the Conservation Commission, the Harvard Climate Initiative Commission, and the Harvard Conservation Trust. Unfortunately, the Stowe and Bolton Independent of this week did not arrive to us in time for today's broadcast. But we're going to go back and do some history, a little bit of history for both Stowe and Bolton. Bolton's East End Historic District. It has traditionally been called the East End. The southeast section of Bolton, located about a mile and a quarter east of Bolton Center, is centered along Main Street and the Great Brook East End Road, Whitcomb Road, and Sugar Road up to Route 495. The East End contains within its 500 acres Bolton's largest and most intact collection of 18th through mid-20th century historic agriculture and domestic resource, along with the remains of Bolton's earliest major industrial enterprise. It also comprises the largest surviving agricultural landscape. Over the past 4 years, preservation consultant Ann Forbes has been at work with the Bolton Historic Commission to carve out a half-mile area in East End comprising 249 acres for acceptance in the National Registry of Historic Places. The period study is from 1736 to 1974. In February of this year, it was accepted by the National Park Services, the Department of Interior, for listing in the National Registry of Historic Places, and the signs have recently gone up. The National Registry Program provides national recognition of the value of historic properties to the nation, eligibility for federal tax incentives and grants, and assistance in cultural resource planning. It does not put any restrictions on what an owner can do within their properties. Settlement of this area began before the town's incorporation in 1738, when John Wickham came into possession of over 1,000 acres in the northeast portion of what has become known as Lancaster's Bolton Territory. For over 150 years, members of the Wickham family set up homesteads and began subsistence farming. Over the centuries, farming had become specialized, and today, Bolton Spring Farm, with its fruit orchards, operates on land that had been in agricultural use for over 300 years. Industry was also crucial in the early economic growth and development of the district. In the early 18th century, the Wickham Lime Quarry and lime kiln began operation on what is now 42 acres of conservation land to the north of Great Brook. In the early 19th century, Moses Wilder, along with his son Abraham, were blacksmiths working out of their shop next to the house at 179 Main Street. In the 1860s and 70s, Henry Kent made cigars out of this shop. Other industrial operations with unknown exact locations include an 18th century fulling mill, a 19th century pump log mill, and a possible 19th century okra mine. These are 18 buildings, 7 sites, 4 structures, and 1 object of historic significance in the district. To learn more about the resources of the East End Historic Sisters District, go to the Massachusetts Historic Commission website, which is mhc-macris.net. It's easy to see how Bolton Spring Farms apple orchards and recreation at the lime kiln and quarry conservation exemplify Bolton's past and present contribution to Bolton's unique sense of place. Stowe, down from the changing roads of Stowe. What may one be one of the most interesting things about the old maps of Stowe is the fact that they show that almost every main street in town has existed since 1830 or before, and all main roads were there by the 1875 map. Yes, new neighborhoods have carved out new streets throughout the town since, but the main thoroughfares are quite old. The town has seen a few changes to these roads over the years, though. The most notable changes have been to Great Road. The earliest main road through town, today's Great Road, was called the Lancaster Road in 1794 map. It had many twists and turns that it does today. Today's Crescent Street was part of the original Lancaster Road. The road was straightened in 1810, according to Cowell, before the 1830 map. But few residents were on the new road at that early date. Most people still lived along Crescent Street. By 1875, Great Road was filled with houses in the center of town. To change the road had a significant effect on those living and doing business on today's Crescent Street. The stagecoach from Boston no longer pass through houses or businesses, putting once-thriving taverns out of business. Crowell writes, because of this change, many of the taverns were closed as taverns, the traffic going in other directions. Among those was the old Rice Tavern, which was closed as a tavern in 1815. The other major change to Great Road was on the far western end of town. Today's old Bolton Road was once part of the Lancaster Road, dipping south to avoid the wetlands, as seen on the 1794 map. By 1830, Old Bolton Road was now a separate road from Great Road. It did, however, connect to Bolton in 1830, as seen on the 1830 maps of both Stowe and Bolton. All the way through the 1875 map of Stowe, unlike today, Great Road was rebuilt along that section a number of times due to the wet conditions of the surrounding land. Gleasondale Road was also saw changes over the years. Originally, the road continued to the southeast below the bridge at the Azabet River, following today's Marlboro Road to Chestnut Road, according to the 1830 map. By the time the Middlesex County map of 1856 was released, there was a road continuing to the southwest, today's present continuation of Gleasondale Road, in addition to the original road that followed southeast. There are three main streets that do not appear in 1830 but are present by 1856. Sudbury Road was much shorter originally, ending at the intersection of Boone and Whitman. By 1856, it was completed to Gleasondale Road. South Acton Road was built off of West Acton Road in 1847 and was the main road to South Acton from the center of town. The other being Red Acre Road. Built in 1802, according to Crowell, the third road built between 1830 and 1856 was Edson Street, connecting Randall Road to Hudson Road in the northwest, though the road looks different in the 1856 and 1871 Middlesex County maps than it does in the Stowe 1875 map. Some roads have disappeared since the early maps. Most of them were lost to the land that is now the Azabet Wildlife Refuge. In the 1875 map has one curiosity. There are dotted lines used instead of solid lines on the map in two places. The first appear to be intended to show a road to a single property off of Harvard Road, east of the intersection with Hiley Brook Road. Other maps in 1856 and 1871 show solid lines for this road, however. Wedgwood Road is in this vicinity today. The second location is between Hudson Road, across from Edson Street, near present-day Athens Road, and Teal Road, near today's Kettle Plain Road, appearing to connect the properties from the 1875 map of A.M. Teal and Cavan Hale with George and Silas Hale. There is no road there currently through Athens and Kettle Plain. Do come close to each other and are very close to that original dotted line. Since these early maps, neighborhoods have sprung up all around town. New streets are added quite often, causing the maps to change all the time. Stowe Taverns, at one point in time, both during Crowell's and Child's history books on Stowe, the town had 16 taverns, many of which served as inns. These businesses were most likely active when the stagecoach was running from Boston to Fitchburg in the 18th and 19th centuries. Once the stagecoach era ended, some remained in as inns for Boston area visitors who came to Stowe in the summer for the fresh air and open spaces, or for local gatherings and galas. When taverns are most likely known today for being places to sell alcohol and food, they were primarily places to rest along the stagecoach line in those early years. The driver could get some refreshment and food while the horses were switched out to a fresh pair for the remaining journey. The coach would leave Boston at 8 in the morning, arrive in Stowe around noon. After the driver had sufficiently rested and eaten, and the new horses were hitched, the coach was back on the road to Fitchburg, arriving at 5 in the evening. According to Childs, the 4-hour schedule between Boston and Stowe was maintained rain or shine, mud or fair-wheeling. Of the many taverns and inns once dotted the Stowe landscape, only a few of those buildings remain, and all of those are now private homes. Often, fire was the cause of destruction. Sometimes, the buildings had gone into a state of disrepair. In one instance, the federal government took the property for the ammo dump, now the Azabet Wildlife Reserve. We're going to take a break for another public service announcement, and then Bob Brady will be back to finish our hour.
Did you know ADA paratransit riders in Worcester, Auburn, Boylston, Leicester, Northboro, Oxford, Westboro, and West Boylston now have the option to schedule trips through the Worcester Regional Transit Authority's new online reservation system? Call customer service at 508-791-9782 or email paratransit@therta.com to begin scheduling your trip online.
This is Bob Brady back with Audio Journal. The time is 3:45. I'm going to continue with articles from the Marlboro Hudson Community Advocate. Buttonwood tree endured for century in Colliery Square. This is the Marlboro Then and Now column by Linda Rennie. Many older Marlboro residents will remember some of the city's tree-lined streets. So many of these trees have been taken down to widen the roads. This is a story of the buttonwood tree that stood in the middle of Colliery Square. Colliery Square is located at the junction of Main Street and East Main Street, what was once Fairbanks Corner. The square was named after Sergeant John P. Colliery, a laborer, motorman, and policeman who served in the Spanish-American War and World War I. In 1934, the large buttonwood, or ironwood tree, was well over 100 years old. It stood as a reminder of Marlboro's historic past. When a truck carrying about 15 tons of merchandise crashed into the tree, it left a significant hole and decay was discovered, according to city forester Clifton E. Sowerby. But buttonwood trees are strong, and the damage wasn't enough to cause a serious problem. The decay is believed to have started following a severe storm in 1921. A metal plate was placed over the hole from the crash, and the tree was kept. Attempts to remove the tree were met with protests from older city residents. It is uncertain the exact date the tree finally died, but it was thought to have fallen down in the late 1950s. It was the end of an era in Colliery Square. An early look at plans for a new Richer Elementary School by Sophia Opetisano. The proposed rebuild of the Raymond C. Richer Elementary School in Marlboro has entered its next phase, ahead of schedule. After determining that Richer, built in 1965, was outdated and overcrowded, Marlboro in October entered the feasibility study phase for a new building. Vertex Architecture began drafting a schematic design of the new building, which will remain at the same location as the current school. Under the current plan, the new school would enroll 950 students, making it the largest elementary school in the city. The project is expected to cost roughly $170 million. Vertex project manager Christopher Everly and Christina Baselmans from Lamoureux Pagano Associates presented the proposed design to the Marlboro School Committee on April 14th. They also brought plans to maintain daily operations at the current school during construction. The current Richer Elementary School will remain operational during construction, which is set to begin in 2027. The new building expected to be completed in 2029. Students and staff will not have access to the school's fields while construction is underway, but Everly said temporary, age-appropriate interim play structures will be set up for recess and outdoor physical education. Everly said a priority is to maximize the current site to include parking, a bus loop, parent drop-off, and an emergency access driveway. The current plan will have parking spaces for Richard's 87 teachers with room for 5 visitor spaces. Everly showed the school committee 3-dimensional renderings of the outside of the new Richard School. The site plan depicted a centralized recess area, parking, and space for an outdoor classroom. Bazelmans also presented renderings of the inside of the building, including classrooms, support spaces, and the atrium. Floor plans for the 3 floors were also shown to the school committee. At the end of the month, the schematic design will be submitted to the Massachusetts School Building Authority, which will take time to review and comment on the progression so far and provide comments to Marlboro before moving to the next steps of the process, Everly said. The school committee unanimously voted to endorse the schematic design and send it to the Massachusetts School Building Authority. Indoor mini golf, homemade ice cream, hundreds of plants. Trombetta's Farm is a Marlboro destination, by Tyler Charpentier. It started as a carnation farm in the early 1960s, and it's now a city staple with ice cream, mini golf, and a plant nursery. Trombetta's Farm has blossomed into a one-of-a-kind community treasure. The farm traces its humble beginnings to its original owners, Charlie and Teresa Trombetta. Charlie first developed his expertise in carnation farming at a local farm in Sudbury. After mastering his craft, he purchased a property which has grown into the iconic local attraction it is today. The farm has since been passed down to the 3rd generation of Trombettas, Charlie Trombetta Jr. and his 2 siblings. Over the years, as the market evolved, the farm has outgrown its floral roots and revamped into a modern destination for family fun. The farm's first evolution was in 1978, when it introduced a homemade ice cream stand. This is when Tony Trombetta began creating the company's now signature from scratch ice cream. To ensure the ice cream operation stands the test of time, Tony has been rigorously training Trombetta Jr.'s son, Alex, to one day take the reins of the ice cream stand and lead the farm into its 4th generation. The farm's homemade ice cream is truly in a league of its own. In addition to vanilla and chocolate, the farm proudly serves over 50 specialty flavors, including sherbets and sorbets. Decades of tireless thought, care, and creativity go into these flavors. The Trombetta family carefully crafts each one, always welcoming and incorporating feedback from customers. We've got a lot of vegan customers recently, and we are incorporating their needs. I've tried commercial vegan ice cream, and it's expensive and not the best, said Trombetta Jr. Trombetta Jr. enthusiastically explained how he has been experimenting to create ice cream that offers his customers the most delicious dairy-free experience. We have tried many different bases, like almond milk, coconut milk, oatmeal milk, and a coconut-oat milk combination. But some don't whip well. Some have an aftertaste. Some don't scoop well. So I just have to try different things until I get it just right, he said. It takes a special kind of place and a special kind of owner to endure the trial and error process needed to perfect each ice cream flavor for every customer. But that's just part of the Trombetta's Farm charm. Delicious homemade ice cream has a way of drawing crowds. This led to the farm's recent ice cream truck endeavor. Whether you're hosting a corporate or school event, celebrating a wedding, or planning a graduation party, Trombetta's ice cream is always the perfect cherry on top of any occasion. Following the addition of the ice cream stand, the farm launched its indoor mini golf course in 1985. Located inside the farm's original greenhouse, the course allows you to compete against family and friends in a sea of green. There are numerous live species of plants and trees offering a one-of-a-kind mini-golf experience. The greenery doesn't stop there. Trombetta's doubles as a plant nursery. Come brighten up your space with annuals, perennials, hanging baskets, patio pots, gift plants, and seasonal flowers. Even if you're new to the plant world and are buzzing with botanical questions and concerns, Trombetta's is there to support you at every step of the way. At Trombetta's, you'll never get sent an automated voicemail or play a stressful game of phone tag while trying to figure out how much sun your new hydrangea needs. Trombetta Jr. takes pride in personally assisting every single one of his customers. I like to answer the phone and talk to people. I might miss a call once in a while, but they are always forwarded to my personal cell. This gives me the ability to shoot them a text and ask them to please let me know if they have any questions. And a majority of the time, they will text back, he said. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule in either large print or Braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org. This is Bob Brady, along with Alan Chapman. Thank you for listening.
This is Bird Note. Dr. Clinton Francis is a sensory ecologist who studies how noise pollution affects birds, like this black-headed grosbeak. He says sounds from machines and vehicles can really disrupt bird behavior because, for most birds, their sense of hearing isn't very good.
Even though birds do rely on acoustics and hearing quite strongly, your typical bird hears about half as well as we do.
Birds rely on their hearing to sense predators and prey and for mating. They need to hear each other's songs and calls in order to communicate and find each other. That makes them very sensitive to noise pollution. Clinton says some species, like the black-headed grosbeak, will just avoid places that get too loud for them.
In our long-term study sites in New Mexico, where we've studied how noise from essentially the energy sector restructures bird communities, we see a complete loss of about one-third of species in noise-polluted areas.
But Clinton says there are lots of ways to help, from switching to quieter electric vehicles to using lawn equipment outside of morning hours when birds are singing the most. Rakes are strongly encouraged. Or just leave the leaves. Learn more about what you can do to reduce noise pollution on the Bring Birds Back podcast. Listen in your favorite podcast app or at birdnote.org. I'm Tasha Lawson.
Hi, my name's Owen Devlin, and this is my story. When my doctor told me I was losing my vision, I was devastated. I worried about my future. How would I attend college, find a great job, start a family, or even travel around my own neighborhood? Luckily, my doctor also told me about the Mass Commission for the Blind. They connected me and my family to a counselor who helped us to set a vision for my future, one that included assistive technology to allow me to go to school and find a meaningful job, a white cane to help me navigate, and even tips on how to use Google Maps on my mobile phone. I found out that losing my vision wasn't the end of the world.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450. or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450, or visit mass.gov/MCB.